It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. When Pittsburgh native Joseph Bethanty was 23 years old and had just completed his master's degree in English, he volunteered for the VISTA program, the domestic version of the Peace Corps. Mr. Bethanty was assigned to the North Carolina Department of Corrections, working with inmates. That experience would change the course of his life. Today, Mr. Bethanty is the Poet Laureate of North Carolina and Professor of Creative Writing at Appalachian State University. And this month, the Senator John Hines History Center's Italian American Collection is hosting him as its first scholar in residence. He joins me now in Studio A. Joseph Bethanty, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
The year is 1976. You have just finished graduate school at Pitt. What led you to become a VISTA volunteer, and what did your family think about your decision?
Paul, I always like to say that I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point, but I had a really long list of things I couldn't stomach the thought of doing. So I just threw my name in the hat, applied to VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America. I was accepted, and because I was a generalist, meaning I wasn't an attorney, I wasn't a nurse, I wasn't a plumber, I just had a lot of degrees in English, I was sent to the North Carolina Department of Correction. And I think initially my family, especially my mom, was in denial that I was actually going to do this. I'm the first person with my name to go to college, and then I went to graduate school. They were terrifically proud of all that. And then I decided to take off to work 500 miles away for $2,000 a year working with criminals. And they were shocked but supportive.
How did that experience impact your life in general and your writing in particular?
You know, it changed my life in all ways, Paul. The very first day of training, I was seated with a young woman from Atlanta who 14 months later I married. So I met my wife loosely, jokingly, in prison. We were assigned to the same prison project. So when I left Pittsburgh, I was burning to write, hadn't written anything at all. So apart from the ways in which moving to North Carolina changed my life in so many wonderful ways, suddenly stepping on a prison yard instantly handed me a pretty dramatic narrative to write about. I hadn't had any experiences of that ilk with that kind of flair and that kind of extremity. So suddenly, again, I was immersed in the world of prison and the kinds of people who find themselves in prisons. And I began to write about that almost instantly.
You published your first book of poetry in 1987, and next year you will bring out your 15th volume. What are the themes that you deal with in your work?
My work really, Paul, is divided almost in half. Half of those books are set in North Carolina, certainly the natural world. We've lived in the country all of our lives, Southern culture, which I'm fascinated by. But what really, I think, changed my writing life or launched my writing life is when I discovered that I had had a pretty rich life in Pittsburgh, and I began to mine that trove of material, started to write about Pittsburgh as place, because I think place authenticates writing in ways often nothing else does. I began to write about my family. I began to write about being an Italian American. I wrote a lot about East Liberty. I wrote...
You almost said Sliberty. You know, did you
I
know
had that? To stop myself.
That's the colloquialism. That's,
of course.
You hear people say it, and people from out, you know, when you're, say, in a place like North Carolina, if you meet somebody from Pittsburgh and you say East Liberty, they'll say, oh, yeah, Sliberty.
I hear it all the time. So I started to write about those streets that I roamed as a kid in East Liberty.
And your first novel is called East Liberty, and it's based on your experiences growing up in a part of Pittsburgh some of us know very well. I grew up there. I remember it as a much grittier place than it is now. What are some of those experiences that you had, and how did they inform the writing of this particular novel?
That particular novel sprung out of a failed short story, a six-page short story that in the year 2000, I decided I was going to revise over Thanksgiving break because I had a little break from teaching. So I sat down and began to revise the story, and it grew page by page by page. And truly, by the end of May, I had a novel. And it's about a young boy who grows up fatherless. His mother is a rather mysterious woman who works at the candy counter at Sears and Roebuck on Highland Avenue. He loves to play baseball. He's obsessed with Catholicism. He wants to be a priest. So a lot of those things come right out of my life, but a lot of them are wholly imagined. For instance, after my mother read the novel, she said to me, "I didn't know you wanted to be a priest." And I said, "Well, that's because I didn't, Mother. That character in the book wants to be a priest." But I think that it's a kind of reflex that a lot of readers have to associate an autobiographical novel a little too closely with the author's life. So there's a lot about that book that is me but isn't.
Well, you grew up in the Catholic school system.
I did.
Sacred Heart.
I started at Saints Peter and Paul on Larimer Avenue with my sister. That's the parish we belong to. And the rhythm of my life was regulated by that church. We went to Mass every day at 8 o'clock before school. I was a choir boy. Later, I was an altar boy when we moved to Sacred Heart after Saints Peter and Paul closed. Then I went to Central Catholic. So that education, the influence of Catholicism, has been terrifically influential and powerful in throughout all my writing. Even the writing that I do about North Carolina, I feel like that sense of Catholicism, the rhythms, the sounds permeate that work as well.
Is part of that experience to identify with the priests, in particular if you're a boy, because you're imagining what it's like as a student sitting there listening to them, or being in church every morning as you were, listening to them or watching them at work, and maybe wondering what it would be like to live that life. And in the Catholic Church, you can't get married, so you know you're really devoted to it. Did you find yourself kind of imagining what they go through, and did that in some way inform the novel, the character in the novel?
You know, the mystery of whatever they were doing up there on the altar, I was always drawn to it and mystified by it. It's a secret club, if you will, the notion, too, of the transubstantiation. And I came of age after Vatican II, but the Latin Mass, there's a kind of secrecy there. And I did imagine their lives, although they seemed like very powerful people, but I wasn't interested in ever being a priest, since it just seemed beyond my capabilities for so many for so many reasons. But I was again influenced by what they did.
Talk about some of the other experiences that you had growing up in East Liberty. It was a place where you could go to the National Record Mart, and you know, for a lot of kids in that part of the town, that's where you got your first Beatles album, maybe. Or you mentioned the woman, the character in the book, in your novel, working at the candy counter at Sears, and you know, a lot of kids, you know, would run by that counter and, you know, be told to slow down or be quiet.
Sure.
You know, because in those days kids had to behave themselves. But then you'd get outside in the street sometimes, and you turn a corner, and there may be somebody waiting to beat you up. That's the kind of place East Liberty was. I'm curious about your experiences and how they may have informed some of your other work or that book.
At the risk of waxing too sentimentally over the good old days, let me just talk about what it was like. I often say that I feel like I had one of the last great American childhoods. It was just terrific work growing up there, but it was very provincial too. The rhythm of my life was Dilworth Schoolyard, Peabody Field, where I learned to play baseball and in other sports.
On dirt and oil
and glass often, too. and I played Little League down on Larmer Avenue, Paulson Avenue. My dad was my coach. If you cut through a yard, you were in your grandmother's house. You cut through another one, your aunt's house. My sprawling, voluminous extended family on both sides, we lived probably within a mile radius of one another, so that I was constantly around family. Stagno's Bakery, the Hoover Street Bridge, the Spinier's Club, Paul Parolo's Barbershop. I could go, you know, I could just go on and on and on. I never wanted to leave those places. It was a small world, but it was well big enough for me, and it was a world that I continue to wholly imagine in my work. You know, Faulkner, though I'm would never compare myself to the brilliant Faulkner, talked about Yaknapatawpha County and that little postage stamp that he would map out in his work for the rest of his life. I can write about that place and those zany, unimaginable characters forever. And there was danger too, I might add, as I got older, the racial strife as civil rights began to bubble up and profoundly affect the way things were going in the neighborhood. So,
and that was a neighborhood where there was sort of a dividing line, an invisible line in East Liberty, where so many cultures met. Italians met up with Irish, Catholics, and Jewish coming from Staten Heights, Jewish kids, and black and white kids.
Sure, sure. So it was rich in that way, but it was not idyllic. I don't want to say that it was necessarily advanced in its thought. And it's making a comeback, apparently, after the redevelopment decimated it in the early to middle 60s. And that's when we moved. My parents, we were living on Collins Avenue at the time, and our side of the street was knocked down, my grandmother's house, a few of my aunts. And that's when we left St. Peter and Paul and went up to Sacred Heart Parish in Shadyside, and my parents moved to Highland Park. And then my life changed all over again because I was suddenly in Sacred Heart with another pedigree of kids that became also wonderful friends to me. My life got larger, and then I moved. Then when I went to Central Catholic and was taught there, my life changed all over again because I had – that was the most influential 4 years maybe of my young life, because it was there that the seeds – to become a writer were planted, and we had these fire-breathing teachers that truly that handed me books that I read that changed my life. And my debt to those teachers in Central is just lifelong.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is the poet laureate of North Carolina, Pittsburgh native Joseph Bethanty, who, as you've been hearing, grew up in East Liberty and is relating much of the interesting details of his childhood. I was wondering if you could share a poem with us, maybe one that reflects some of what we're talking about.
Okay, I will. I feel like this poem I'm about to read has some ways become my signature Pittsburgh poem. It's called Knocked, and it's not like when you knock on a door. It's my dad had a saying that people had it knocked, which is this synonymous with people had it made. And the poem is about the first time I saw where my dad, who was a steel worker at Edgar Thompson, worked. And it was only because I needed our car. We had one car, a 1963 Chevy Bel Air, and I needed the car for the after prom picnic. So this is a poem about my dropping off my dad at E.T. in Braddock one morning where he worked all those years steadily in anonymity and never complained. I had a dear father and a dear mother who was a seamstress. I come from real working class people who dreamed up this life that I get to live, really because of their blood and sweat. So this is called Knocked. I was 17 before I saw Edgar Thompson, the steel mill where my father had worked since he was 17, and only then because I needed his car for the senior after prom picnic. The theme was Color My World. Sleepless, having danced all night, a furnace of cheap champagne and still in my tuxedo, I dropped him off at 7 a.m. in Braddock, named for a Revolutionary War general, three bars in every block, streetlights turned on in the afternoon so the school kids could see their ways home through the ore dust. The mill was blue and corrugated, rising in shaft after shaft of smoke that sawtoothed into gray sky. I never saw its top. The men in the boom crane cabs wore hard hats and drank coffee. They had it knocked, my father said, but not him. He had to climb the backs of those monsters. When I was little and insisted I wanted to be like him and work in the mill, he'd snap, "No, you're not. You're going to college in a few months." I really would be going to college. Working in a steel mill was the last thing I wanted to do. My father eased out of the car, handed me a 20, told me to be careful, pinned on his millwright's badge, and filed into the smoke with the others. I turned up the radio, dropped the engine into low for torque, and floored it, sure that in one night I had had more fun, more love, more everything than he had had in his life, and I wanted to get back to it as fast as I could.
That's Pittsburgh native and poet Joseph Bethanty. He is the poet laureate of North Carolina. Very interesting piece.
Thank you.
Has your family, after their initial misgivings about what you went off to do after you finished graduate school, how have they embraced what you are doing?
You know, my family they have always been so supportive and loving, not just my mom and dad. And my mom and dad are gone now, but my extended family, my aunts and uncles and cousins and my beloved sister Marie, And my, you know, my sons and wife, they've just been wonderfully supportive and proud and terrific cheerleaders. And it, you know, my debt is to my extended family, not just for the material, but again, I can't imagine this kind of thing happening to me. All the good things that have happened if I hadn't had this kind of family. So. You know, they were really, my parents were really proud.
How does one become the poet laureate of a state, in this case, North Carolina? What is the process that you go through?
Paul, one is nominated. A call goes out from the North Carolina Arts Council and the Department of Cultural Resources just across the state for nominations. So there can be any number of nominations. I've been nominated before. I was a finalist once before, but of course you just don't expect an honor like this to happen. So a panel of scholars and other writers is assembled. The applications are vetted, and then just the process, the bracket narrows and narrows and narrows, and then it came down to three people, and that's when I got the call that my name would be sent to the governor along with two other writers. And again, my home state now of North Carolina, which I care for deeply, is crawling with fabulous writers, terrific poets. So
James Taylor's from
there. And James Taylor, for goodness sake. So it wasn't something that I expected to get. But lo and behold, I did, and it's been just an honor I can't describe.
And you do this, you do it for 2 years. It's a 2 year position.
It's a 2 year tenure, and there's the possibility that I'll be reappointed, but it's typically a 2 year tenure.
And what are the duties of the poet laureate?
One goes into schools, and you know, in my case, I go public schools, colleges, arts councils, shelters, hospitals, prisons. I've visited a Girl Scout troop. I've been to assisted living facilities, you name it. And
spreading,
I was all
poetry.
Yeah, yeah. And in other kinds of writing and reading my work and doing workshops, judging contests, you name it. you name it. It's a broad menu.
And one doesn't necessarily get rich from this. I think it was in Nebraska, the poet laureate of the state of Nebraska, is, you know, he's your insurance guy. He happens to be an insurance agent.
Right, right. And of course, my straight job, as I like to say, I'm a English professor at Appalachian State University. But my signature project as the poet laureate, I was asked to declare one, is working with returning combat vets, all vets really, and their families to harvest their stories through poetry and in other kinds of writing. So I've gone to Walter Reed. I've gone to the National Intrepid Center of Excellence. I've worked with the Veterans Writing Project in D.C., and I'm in and out of VA hospitals. So that's been a really humbling and rewarding experience, and I've gotten way more out of those experiences than I think what I've dispensed.
How do you teach somebody to write? Writing is seen by many as a God-given ability like athleticism. Either you have it or you don't, and you might be able to help somebody improve how they express themselves, but when it comes to really doing fluid writing, that seems like something that would be very difficult to teach.
You know, I'm thinking about, for instance, walking into an audience with folks who don't typically think of themselves as writers, and I'll be doing something like that on January 25th at the Heinz Museum Italian American Collection, where I'll be teaching a memoir workshop this Saturday from 1 to 4. What I like to say is everyone has stories. Period. Everyone has them. Writers have this, pathological kind of compulsion to write them down. So I go in and say, you have stories. Flannery O'Connor, the great Georgia writer, says, if you survived your childhood, you have enough to write about for the rest of your life. So predicated on that, everyone is walking around with just a trove of stories. So I try and just get them to begin to dig into memory, become aware of some of those stories, and not to get too conscious about that they're writing those stories, but just to get them down in a narrative, in their language. And I'm fond of saying there is no writing, only rewriting, and just getting them down, essentially, and then going back. A lot of the kids that I teach at Appalachian State, because I teach exclusively creative writing, are very passionate about writing when they get there. And, of course, the writer's greatest tool is reading. It's like watching game films.
And I mentioned you're in Pittsburgh this month as the first scholar in residence at the Senator John Heinz History Center's Italian American Collection. So before we wrap this up, tell folks about the assignment you have as the scholar in residence.
Okay, it's worked out perfectly for me to do this the last 2 weeks in January, because the first 2 weeks, every January, I teach in Carlo University's low residency MFA program. I've done that for the past 8 years, and they're celebrating their 10th anniversary this year. A stellar program at Carlo, run by Dr. Ellie Weimert. So I began a conversation with Melissa Marinaro, who is the curator of the Italian American Collection, just doing a wonderful job building that collection. And we mapped out this 2 weeks where I would be the inaugural scholar in residence. So while there, I'm looking at all the oral histories, photographs, letters, especially letters from Italian American veterans from World War II, letters that they had sent home, because it dovetails so nicely into my work with veterans. And I'm going to produce some kind of work while I'm there. I also want to give visibility to the Italian American Collection, and also to help pioneer this residency for the folks who follow me. So, as I mentioned, on Saturday I'll be conducting a workshop. I'll be giving a reading on the 31st at Chatham University at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow I'll be at La Roche giving a reading at 7 o'clock. I'll be tomorrow also at Upper St. Clair High School, working with some high school kids, and I'll be with a second grade class at Myrtle School in the South Hills, too.
Well, hopefully all this will leave you time to get a slice of Vento's pizza while you're still in Pittsburgh.
I'll, I'll be at Vento's. I've eaten a lifetime of Vento's pizza over the years, too, and then walked across the street and got a 7-cent cherry Coke at the old Highland Pharmacy on the way home. So,
Joseph Bethanty is the Poet Laureate of North Carolina and Professor of Creative Writing at Appalachian State University. And this month, the Senator John Hines History Center's Italian-American Collection is hosting him as its first scholar in residence. Joseph Bethanty, thanks for joining me on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a great pleasure.
Coming up, we'll hear about the Pittsburgh Mini-Grant Awardees. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.